Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. A fascinating story this hour. Dean Strang is the author of Worse Than the Devil, Anarchists, Clarence Darrow, and Justice in a Time of Terror. In 1917, there was a bomb that exploded in a Milwaukee police station, killing 9 officers and a civilian. The people who were responsible were never really caught, but because of what was going on in this country in 1917, World War I, and what was going on with immigrants, police and the people who do newspapers and the public assumed that the perpetrators were Italian. And the story goes on. It's got a lot of layers to it. Clarence Darrow led an appeal that gained freedom for most of the convicted. It also looks at political points of view, immigrants, the role of immigrants in all of this, and why it is that this particular story, more American police officers died in a foreign terrorist bombing in Milwaukee in 1917, Dean writes, than any other single event until September 11, 2001. It should be of more historical interest than it has been so far, but he's seeking to rectify that with his book. Dean was one of the first federal defenders in Wisconsin. He was the first, actually. He's offered oral arguments in more than 20 appeals, including in the U.S. Supreme Court, the Wisconsin Supreme Court, U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, and 3 other circuits. He has served as and is an adjunct professor of law at Marquette University Law School and also at UW-Madison. And today we talk about his first book. He's one of the founders of the Wisconsin Coalition Against the Death Penalty, and for more than 15 years, he lived on the Milwaukee block that was the scene of the September 1917 riot. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Dean Strang. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org, and our Facebook page, if you'd like to leave a message there, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Dean. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, our pleasure. Why is it that this was really a very important historical event, and yet all of the books have been written about what happened in Chicago, in Haymarket, rather than what happened in Milwaukee? Why are we not very noticed? Until, of course, your book.
Well, mine actually isn't the first book about this. But it is true that the events in Milwaukee in 1917 have gotten a good deal less attention than the riot in Haymarket Square in 1886. I don't know why. I mean, Chicago is certainly a bigger city, and the Haymarket riot, I think, probably marked the first moment that Americans broadly paid attention to anarchist ideology of the day, maybe.
You lived on this block where this took place for a number of years. Is that how this became of interest to you? Did people on the block, were they aware of the historical significance?
If they were, I didn't hear it from them. And in general, my sense of the neighborhood back in the 1990s, mid-1990s, when I got interested in this story, was that most of the old-timers who would have remembered were fading or gone already. Mm-hmm. I discovered it really through an accident that arose mostly from my interest in Clarence Darrow, which dated back to law school for me.
And what was that accident?
Well, one evening in the mid-90s when I should have been working and billing hours, I was instead goofing off, and I wondered whether Clarence Darrow ever had appeared in the Wisconsin Supreme Court. And I got on Westlaw, I checked, I found that he had, and as I delved into the opinion, which turned out to be the Supreme Court's opinion in this case, I discovered that not only were the events that it described fascinating, but that they had originated on the corner of my block.
Hmm. That was your idea of goofing off? I thought you were going to tell some other kind of story. That was a pretty serious goofing off, wasn't it, Dean?
Well, my employer would have viewed it as goofing off.
Oh, Okay, I guess it's all relative. Why don't you, because this is not very well known, describe exactly what happened in 1917, where the police station was, what the story was.
Well, the story of the bombing happens on November 24, 1917. And it doesn't begin at the police station because the bomb was not intended for the police station. It begins with a scrub woman and her 9-year-old daughter at the Methodist church of a man named Reverend August Giuliani. That stood at the time on would be the northwest corner of what is now Van Buren and Michigan in the city of Milwaukee. It's now a parking lot. Saturday morning, cold, raw day, not so unlike today. The cleaning woman's daughter found a strange package leaning against the outside southern wall of the church, alerted her mom. Mom dragged the package in, by one account, bouncing it down each step into the basement of the church. And for several hours, the settlement worker and other members of the congregation sort of looked and poked at the package, suspecting that it was a bomb. Finally, late in the afternoon, someone got the bright idea, maybe we ought to call the police. They went next door to the YWCA, which had a telephone, called the police. The central police station at that point stood on what is today Broadway and Wells, the southeast corner of that. It was Broadway and Oneida in 1917. When the police didn't respond immediately, I think because it was a shift change, the settlement worker assigned a teenage boy and his friend to tote this 20-pound package to the police station. They handed it to the desk sergeant. He recognized it as a bomb, but thought it was unusual or an atypical bomb of those they saw in those days, and bombs weren't infrequent at the time. He thought the detectives ought to examine it, took it into the detectives' assembly room. They gathered around it, thought it was interesting too, and it blew up.
Mm. You say that bombs weren't infrequent at the time. What does that mean?
Well, the newspapers in Milwaukee and in other cities were full. Now, if not full, at least frequently reported finding of dynamite bombs, set probably in connection with labor unrest, set in connection with broader discontent with workers or of workers, really was not all that infrequent. And it's hard to assign responsibility for those. In the Milwaukee mainstream newspapers of the day, they tended to assign responsibility for bombs to the Italian population, but it's hard at this remove to know whether that was fair.
Mm-hmm. Now, those who were charged with this, 11 alleged Italian anarchists, but they were initially charged with something else that had happened a couple months earlier. Is that right?
The 11 of whom you speak never were charged with the bombing, and indeed they couldn't have been directly responsible, at least, because all of them were in jail when the bomb was placed and found, awaiting trial on the events to which you've alluded, the Rose and Bay View on September 9, 1917.
And what were those events?
The events of that day were what might be described as a melee, a fracas, a minor riot, but one that involved some shooting. Not a great number of people, but some shooting. And that arose on the third Sunday that the same minister I mentioned a few moments ago, Reverend August Giuliani, had led his congregation down to the newer Italian immigrant enclave in Bayview from the Third Ward, there to talk to the Bayview Italians about either their patriotic duty to support America's war effort then just 4 or 5 months underway, or to evangelize, depending on whose version of the story you believe. But in any event, Giuliani's visits didn't sit well on the three successive Sundays that he visited Bayview. And on the third of those, fighting broke out. The catalyst, if you will, was an undercover police officer roughing up one of the neighborhood Italians in an effort to quiet his catcalling. Shooting broke out. Everyone scattered. It was over within a minute or two. But when the smoke cleared, literally, one Italian lay dead in the street. Another lay there dying. And two police officers had been grazed by bullets.
Hmm. And Giuliani's message didn't sit very well because what? What was going on in the Italian community?
Well, as I say, these were newer Italian immigrants than the Third Ward contingent. That those who primarily had settled in the Third Ward mostly were from Sicily or the southern part of the boot. They had come two, three decades earlier, really fleeing famine. A later wave of Italian immigrants from the central and northern regions of Italy came in the early 20th century, much less assimilated, and many of those settled in Bayview clustered in what was called the Italian colony at the time, and they either worked in or in jobs related to the vast steel rolling mill that sat down on the lakeshore just north of Bayview, I mean, sort of occupying the land on which the Port Authority of Milwaukee now sits, and then, you know, a much larger parcel to that extending to the south and west.
Mm-hmm. Backbreaking work, too, pretty much cut off. It was almost like an area where they worked and where they lived was cut off from the rest of Milwaukee.
It really was. I mean, literally, at the time, it was somewhat cut off from Milwaukee. Jones Island was really an island back then, and it was a Kashubi Polish fishing village. You know, the land had not been filled in as much, and the factory really provided the reason for people living, many of them in company housing, there on the sandy rise immediately south of the factory in what we know now as Bayview, mm-hmm. and was called then Bayview.
So put all of this against the backdrop of World War One and different viewpoints within this Italian immigrant, depending on where you were from, community. What were there very, very different ideas about participation in World War One? What patriotism meant?
There really were. Of course, the earlier wave of Italians had done what all immigrants to the United States have done over the years, which is try very hard to assimilate into the broader culture. And many of the Italian immigrants who'd been there for 20, 30 years had come a great distance in assimilating and were in the main, you know, or at least I think the majority of them probably eager to show that they were loyal Americans and supporting the war effort. The much newer immigrant population from Italy down in Bayview, I think, had stronger ties still to the land of their birth. Italy had, in a sense, changed sides as World War One unfolded. It had had a decades-long alliance with Austria, which it severed during World War One and joined the side of the English, French, you know, what we think of as the Allies. And this left some resentment among many Italians and Italian immigrants to the United States. Also, I think it's fair to say that this was an unassimilated group and that probably their image of America was greater than the reality they found mm-hmm. when they arrived at our shores, and that they were discontent with their station in life and the realities of work on the lowest rungs of the employment ladder in this country. So they were not enthusiastic supporters of the war. Some of them probably also subscribed to a leftist ideology, whether they were anarchists in any organized sense or socialists or just, you know, sort of, as I say, discontent with mm-hmm. their position in life.
So when you look at the bomb and where it was intended to go off and who the target was intended, and you have to look, we don't actually know because it was never really investigated, but you know more than probably anybody did then. Who was it intended for? What was this bomb for?
Oh, it was clearly intended for Giuliani's church. Mm-hmm. It was his church that it was placed next to. It was on a timer, a rough, you know, sort of crude timer, but it probably was intended to explode either Saturday evening when a meeting was expected in the church or possibly the next morning for Sunday services. At either time, the church would have been packed with congregants. The bomb was meant to be lethal to human beings. It was packed with screws and bolts and other heavy metal shrapnel.
And who were his enemies, Giuliani's?
Well, it's probably at least some of the people in the Bayview neighborhood, who, as I say, had not welcomed his visits beginning in late August that year and culminating on September 9. He was seen by at least many of them as proselytizing for a Protestant faith. Most of them, of course, would have been Roman Catholic by birth. Mm-hmm. His political message also wasn't welcomed, I'm sure, by many. So he at least was an antagonist, one of the antagonists in the events in September in Bayview, and those at least would have been some of his enemies.
But those who were responsible for this were never apprehended. Why was that?
Well, I can't know, and no one can know for sure. I can offer some thoughts about that.
Please.
First, after the bomb exploded, the evening of November 24, the police went out and rounded up probably two dozen, roughly, people. But these were sort of the usual suspects. It was clear from the newspapers that they were all Italian. But I'm guessing that they were the usual suspects. And in the early hours and days following the bombing, the police were assuring the public that a confession was imminent, that the crime would be solved. It really never was. And part of the reason, only part I'm sure, is one, the Milwaukee Police Department had no Italian speakers at the time. It really couldn't police the Italian neighborhoods, if Italians indeed were responsible, from the inside. You know, didn't have good relationships with citizens in those neighborhoods and couldn't speak to them in their native tongue.
Mm-hmm.
Two, there was almost no federal law enforcement presence. And this seems very strange to us today, but there appears to have been one federal law enforcement officer assigned to the entire eastern third of Wisconsin at the time. And I don't know that the federal law enforcement bureaucracy, such as it was, connected well from one part of the country to another. And again, that seems very strange to us today, but federal law enforcement was rudimentary then. The America's leading professor of anarchist history, a man named Paul Avrich, who died 6-7 years ago, concluded, without really explaining why very thoroughly, but he concluded that a man named Mario Buda probably built the bomb. Buda was an Italian anarchist, a master bomb maker from out east, but what he did was travel around the country by train or send emissaries with bombs that he had manufactured. So today, you know, with the interconnection of law enforcement that we have led through the federal government, this might have been a much more solvable crime.
We welcome phone calls for Dean if you'd like to join our conversation. Dean Strang is the author of Worse Than the Devil, Anarchists, Clarence Darrow, and Justice in a Time of terror. We have yet to get to Clarence Darrow, who's an interesting part of this story as well, and we'll do that momentarily. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page, if you would like to use that, is the Kathleen Dunn Show. The book is about the bombing which exploded in a Milwaukee police station intended for another target. You heard the story of how it wound up there, killing 9 officers and a civilian. Those responsible never apprehended. The backdrop of this is World War I and immigration. All of the Milwaukee defendants were immigrants. The cases, when you look at Haymarket, which is more publicized, both cases concerned anarchism, a dominant radical and sometimes violent ideology of that era. And it also, the backdrop arose in the early months of America's direct participation in an unprecedented world war. So it's a fascinating case, and Clarence Darrow's involvement in this is as well. It's a parable, as Dean writes, of the human frailty that necessarily weakens every link in any system of justice, including ours today. 800-486-8655. To you, you are listening in a moment. You are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We welcome phone calls for Dean, and our number again is 800-486-8655. Scott in La Crosse is our first caller for you, Dean. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen.
Hi.
I've been very interested in this period of history for a long time. I used to live in Denver, and there was one of the guys, a guy who was based there, was a guy sounded much like your Italian bomb maker Buddha. His name was Harry the Mad Bomber Orchard, and he would go around and do these mostly for the Wobblies. He would be their bomb guy, and he would travel around and do these kind of acts. But the reason I wanted to call in today right now is to ask you your remarks there about federal the agencies responsible for federal law enforcement not being very up to speed at that time is interesting to me, because it's only a couple years after this, in the early 20s, right, that we have the Palmer raids, which is named after, I believe, Wilson's attorney general. And at that time, it seemed like they were very good, at least at cracking down on either communist or alleged communist. And I guess my question for you is, do you know what changes or what goes on in the interim? Is it just the war fever that makes the government get much more involved in wanting to crack down on dissidents, or is there something else that goes on?
Well, Scott, I think there's, as you probably know, there's a confluence of factors in no particular order. 1916, 1917, the fledgling Bureau of Investigation within the Department of Justice is starting to get staffed up more aggressively. And in fact, it's 1917 that a very young man, very young lawyer named John E. Hoover is hired in the Bureau of Investigation and will go on to fame with the successor FBI later, of course. The Espionage Act of 1917, the Immigration Act of 1917, both of those things you fairly, I think, could ascribe to sort of a nativism and a patriotism, a war fever is the term you used, and they lead to a focus on radicals, dissidents, immigrants. Generally, it becomes literally a crime to oppose the draft that President Wilson and Congress instituted to support World War I. The Palmer raids, which you correctly note are named after A. Mitchell Palmer, Wilson's attorney general, occur in 1919. Thousands are rounded up. Actually, many fewer than that really are deported in the end. They are a mix of Bolshevists, as they would have been known at the time, anarchists, and just other malcontents and square pegs in a round hole world. But you are seeing the federal government begin to ramp up enforcement activity across the country. You mentioned the Wobblies, or the industrial workers of the world. It's 1918 that the federal government really cracks down on the IWW across the country, from Sacramento to Chicago and points east and west. So that's all beginning, and I think you rightly ascribe it to the fear and response to a previously unknown scale of war.
So do you think it's, I mean, obviously these things probably go hand in hand, but what would you think is really the biggest driving force, some kind of anti-labor sentiment, or is it really just the nativism, the anti-immigrant racism?
For myself, I suspect it's just fear and a sense that the world was collapsing around people. In a sense, it was. I mean, this was, you know, this conflict involved all of Europe essentially directly and much of the rest of the world indirectly. Recall, too, that in the fall of 1917, the Tsar's dynasty, the Romanov dynasty, collapses. And in a country that spans about a third of the globe's circumference, you have an experiment in Marxist government for the first time. And people really would have been forgiven, I think, for thinking the world was collapsing around them. Labor unrest at home, all the things you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
Fascinating. Thanks so much.
You know, thanks, Scott, very much for the call. All right, let's talk about this trial. The Italians, you write, had an unfair trial. The specter of the larger uncharged crime of the bombing haunted the proceedings and really assured the convictions of all 11 of these Italians. Can you tell me more about the people who were in jail and how that bombing assured convictions of all who were in jail?
The 11 in jail were those who eventually were charged out of the dozens more who were arrested in Bayview in the day or two after the melee there in September. These 11 eventually are charged. Others in time are released. The 11 are in jail awaiting trial, and as fate would have it, their trial is scheduled to begin on Wednesday, November 28, just 4 days after the bomb explodes unintendedly at the police station.
Mm-hmm.
The police station sits hardly more than a block from the courtroom where the 11 are to be tried. At that time, felony cases in Milwaukee County were tried in what was called Milwaukee Municipal Court, very different than a municipal court of today. But it had felony jurisdiction, and it sat on the fourth floor of the Milwaukee City Hall. So the trial begins 4 days later, while there's literally almost smoke hanging in the air from the ruined police station a block away. The trial begins the day after the last of the police officers are buried. And the newspapers from the extra editions that came out within hours after the bombing have been screaming that Italians are responsible, Italian anarchists in specific, and that this is tied to the 11 people who are facing trial on the unrelated charges from Bayview.
So their trial essentially is an unfair trial. It's been described that way. How is it unfair? How do they all get convictions?
Well, from the outset, the judge denies an adjournment, you know, to sort of let passions cool and some time and distance develop between the bombing and the trial. Denies a change of venue, you know, move it to another county where the emotions about the bomb explosion aren't so raw. And throughout the trial, the district attorney, a fascinating local character named Winfred Zabel, repeatedly and explicitly injects the bomb tragedy into the trial of these unrelated charges of the Italians. For that matter, they're all tried on a conspiracy theory. The actual charges themselves are changed the very morning of trial without prior notice to the defendants. The judge clearly had his thumb on one side of the scale, unsurprisingly. And the jury is composed entirely of men who would come from salaried or business classes, you know, socioeconomic status, rather than from the working, the day laboring classes.
Mm-hmm.
Unsurprisingly, after 3 weeks of testimony against 11 people, that jury is out for exactly 17 minutes.
Oh, my goodness.
Before returning guilty verdicts against all 11.
Now, how does Clarence Darrow become involved?
Not until after the trial and sentencing. The 11 are all sentenced to 25 years in prison just a couple of days after Christmas 1917. The judge makes no effort to distinguish them individually by level of culpability or other circumstance. And after they're sentenced, Emma Goldman, probably America's leading anarchist thinker, who's been watching this case closely since its inception, uses her magazine Mother Earth and its successor Mother Earth Bulletin to raise a defense fund for the appeal, asking her readers to send their nickels and dimes in to hire a defense lawyer. She, at that point, is in Chicago, awaiting the outcome of her own appeal from a federal conviction for opposing the draft. That appeal doesn't go well, and she's going to be deported shortly. But before she's sent off to prison, she probably reaches out to Clarence Darrow, whom she knew as another leading figure on the American left at the time. I can't prove that she's the direct connection, but I suspect that she probably had a role in engaging Clarence Darrow to take the appeal on behalf of the 11.
Mm-hmm. And now we get to the point where there's so much in this, isn't there, that there are methods that he is using that are deeply suspect? Clarence Darrow? Really?
Well, really, and then, or maybe in this instance. Now, suspect methods are nothing new. For those who studied Darrow, I mean, he himself stood trial in Los Angeles twice between 1911 and 1913 on allegations of jury bribery. He was acquitted in the first trial, and the second jury hung, and the state of California elected not to try him a third time. But his methods always, even during his lifetime, were the subject of gossip and rightful suspicion. Here we don't know that he did agree corruptly to try to fix the record of this appeal, but there was sworn testimony a few years after the appeal from the assistant district attorney who had assisted Zabel in the trial that there was such a scheme concocted between Zabel, Darrow, or amongst Zabel, Darrow, and this assistant district attorney himself.
And that scheme was what?
Well, the basic idea, at least according to this assistant district attorney's testimony, is that by the spring of 1918, in the early stages of the appeal, both prosecutors, Zabel and his assistant, had such frayed nerves from both death threats in writing and two overt efforts, you know, to take their lives, that they sat down and said, you know, we've got to do something about this. And maybe since Zabel knew Darrow casually, maybe what we ought to do is take the train down to Chicago, meet with Darrow, and tell him, you know, we're worth more to your clients and their friends alive than we are dead.
Hmm.
And if you'll reach out and call off the Italians and their efforts to threaten our lives, we will participate in falsifying the trial record so that it will appear to the Wisconsin Supreme Court that error occurred where none did, and that the court then would reverse the convictions.
Mm-hmm. We're going to welcome more phone calls if you would like to join our conversation. Dean Strang is our guest this hour, and his book is Worse Than the Devil, Anarchists, Clarence Darrow, and Justice in a Time of Terror. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And you can always leave messages on our Facebook page, and that is The Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our guest this hour is Dean Strang. His book is Worse Than the Devil, Anarchist Clarence Darrow and Justice in a Time of Terror. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email, talk@wpr.org. Dean, Clarence Darrow was able to gain freedom for most of those who were convicted, was he not?
He was. He obtained reversals of nine of the convictions in the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and actually later, about 3 years later, obtained the commutation of the sentences of the remaining two.
Mm-hmm. And is there enough question in your mind to think that he may have done this not really on the up and up, or can we say there's enough question that maybe it was on the up and up?
Well, this is where the story really gets deliciously murky and fascinating, I think. We have the testimony from the assistant district attorney that this agreement was struck in Darrow's office. But then that assistant DA leaves his job, leaves office before the appeal progresses very far, and he says he doesn't know whether his boss, Winfred Zabel, and Darrow ever followed through on that agreement. What we do know is that in the end, the Wisconsin Supreme Court reverses seven of the convictions on grounds that could not have been falsified, that couldn't have been contrived by corrupt lawyers. Two of the nine convictions that are reversed, I suppose, arguably could have been falsified or tinkered with corruptly. But in the main, the Wisconsin Supreme Court really did reverse on the merits. So if these people got together to try to put one over on the Supreme Court, in a sense, it failed. The court, you know, it was a case that the defense was destined to win on the merits.
And do you know what happened with those people's lives, what they went on to do?
All or almost all of them went straight from state custody into the arms of the Federal Labor Department, which at the time was in charge of deportation. So all or most, within a few years, were deported back to Italy. Some of them we know. I know of at least three of the 11 who made their way back to our shores eventually, and it appears legally, because they had Social Security numbers and lived openly under their names, and eventually died in the United States.
Hmm. Let's go to Dennis in Milwaukee next. Hi, Dennis.
Yes, good morning.
Hi.
And it's a pleasure to be with you, Dean. Catherine, I'm calling with a question, but before I ask that question, I'm pleased to say that both my grandparents arrived in Bayview from southern and northern Italy at about the same time that these events were evolved. So I have a special interest in it for that reason. But I've also read the book, and I'm very impressed with both the range and the relevancy of the work that Dean has done. I'm curious about the source of his very considerable research that he did in order to gather information and make his observations.
All right, Dean.
Well, a lot of the research, most of it, I was able to do right here in Wisconsin. The Wisconsin Historical Society, its main facility in Madison, has what I think is the fourth largest archive in the world of newspapers. I spent a lot of time there. The grand jury transcripts from which I draw much of this story of possible corruption of appeal are in the Wisconsin Historical Society in Madison. One of the trial lawyers, the lead defense lawyer, left his papers, and those are at the Golden Meier Library in Milwaukee at UWM. So a lot of it I was able to do there, and then there were, of course, were secondary sources as well.
Thank you very much, Dennis, for the call. A lot of people who have read the book and who have commented on it have talked about the fact that there may be lessons that we never learned from this trial, that there are concerns that persist today as our country struggles to administer criminal justice to people who are just here and to those who are outsiders. Is that valid? Are we still struggling with some of the issues? And if so, what might they be?
Oh, I think we are. I think we were before 1917, and I think we probably always will be. All of the institutions that compose our criminal justice system are themselves composed of human beings with all of our biases and failings and, you know, quirks. We're all trapped in our own times in many ways, trapped by our own fears and prejudices, and the fact of the matter is, you know, the frailties, one of the things I've at least tried to, you know, allow to emerge or put on display here are the frailties of the police, of the mainstream media and their role in covering courts and criminal investigations and prosecutions. The defense lawyers were flawed people. The prosecutor was the lead prosecutor was a very flawed guy, and that emerges in the book. The trial judge was only too human. The whole system is no better than the sum of its parts, and those parts are all flawed human beings, every one of us. I speak as a criminal defense lawyer who's spent more than the last quarter century in that system. Mm-hmm. And God willing, we'll spend another quarter century.
And what about racism? Can we look at the role of immigration? Can we look at the role of the other? What thoughts were about Italian immigrants, where they fit into the waves of immigration that came to Milwaukee, and how people formed ideas and prejudices?
Yeah, and that's really interesting stuff, especially as you plow back through the old newspapers. I mean, the racism, the bias against immigrants was very much undisguised at the time. I mean, ridiculous stereotypes that were just advanced as if they were fact. And, you know, we're more subtle about hiding our biases now. But the problem remains, and it's especially acute in times of war or great public upheaval and fear. I mean, you know, World War One, you had anarchists and labor radicals and the people who came to call communists, Bolshevists at the time. But a generation later, after World War Two, it's communists and Eastern European immigrants. In the Vietnam era, it's black nationalists, civil rights activists, student radicals, hippies, SDS, that sort of thing. And in our own day, in a post-September 11 world, it's radical Islamists and Arabic-speaking people who tend to be the objects of our fear and the most distrusted other, as you say. Now, in many ways, African Americans have never overcome that outsider status in our criminal justice system. So it's a problem we've always lived with, and I fear always will. It seems to me that the start of a solution is awareness of the problem.
Mm-hmm. And one of our earlier callers brought this up, this particular time in history. I'm interested in hearing more. You say in the book, anarchism had something to do with Bayview in 1917. Then even if most in Bayview did not know exactly what they had to do with anarchism. Can you talk more about that, the role of anarchism, the attraction of anarchism, and Bayview and all of that?
Sure. I mean, as with any ideology or point of view, there's an elite, there's an avant-garde. I mean, there are the idea people, and anarchism certainly had those, and it had ethnic stripes at the time. So there were Russian anarchists, there were Italian anarchists, Czech anarchists, German anarchists, and here in America, probably the leading anarchist voices were Emma Goldman, Alexander Berkman. There were others like Voltairine de Cleyre, but so we had this elite, and they, of course, needed disaffected workers, masses of people to turn out at rallies or to march to support them, mm-hmm. in a sense, with numbers. And it's hard in looking back now to say whether any of these 11 Italians, the most educated of whom had what would be the equivalent of maybe a fifth grade of education in this country, and several of whom really had a first or second grade education. So it's hard to look back now and say, did they have any organized political philosophy? The one or two who tried to describe their philosophy at trial really offered something that was pretty muddled, albeit coming through an interpreter, which may have added to the muddle. But certainly people like them were instruments, if you will, and I don't mean that entirely cynically, but they were of interest to leaders who sought in the anarchist movement to arouse the public and to galvanize opinion against the capitalist structure of the day.
Mm-hmm. How long was the trial, Dean?
About 3 weeks of testimony. The testimony gets going on November 30 and carries through December 17.
And when you look at it, took a long time to do all of the research for this, and you really had to dig to get to some of the research. What do you come away with it? What kind of lessons do you learn from this that you carry with you, perhaps, in the work that you do and that we all ought to look at in terms of how we take in the immigrant, the other, how we take in potential acts of terrorism and maybe over-respond to that? It's a big canvas here for you.
It is, and the lessons I draw, of course, are very personal, but they are foremost, I guess, two. One, hang on to our ideals, the ideals expressed in the Bill of Rights. I mean, keep hold of these firm ideals, these markers that we have for us as we try to wend our way through the emotions and the troubles of our day. Two, at least as I say for myself, we ought to try to administer justice with a greater sense of humility than we often display. Whether we're talking judges or prosecutors or police officers, the mainstream media, defense lawyers, all of us, really, I think, could use a dose of humility, and probably the public a dose as well, in placing less emphasis on the finality of a conviction for its own sake and investing less certainty that the outcome of a trial has established the truth.
Mm-hmm. Thank you so much for being with us. Very interesting. Thanks for picking up on this event and devoting time to it. Dean Strang, our guest this hour. The book, again, is Worse Than the Devil, Anarchists, Clarence Darrow, and Justice in a Time of Terror. Dean is a criminal defense lawyer in Madison. He's adjunct professor at the law schools at the University of Wisconsin and also at Marquette University. And for a number of years, more than 15 years actually, lived on the Milwaukee block that was the scene of the September 1917 riot. So thanks to Rhonda Fanning and Amanda Magnus for producing this hour. And thanks to Rhonda for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. I just want to remind you, because the deadline for this is coming up. Well, it's coming up soon. Tomorrow, actually. Today's the 10th, right? I'm going to be going to Eau Claire, beautiful part of Wisconsin, for the Western Wisconsin 2013 Listener's Dinner Monday, April 22nd. It's at the Phipps Center for the Arts in Hudson, Wisconsin. And I'll be speaking. We'll be gathering to have a social hour and to eat, always a good thing. $25 per person. If you'd like more information or like to register, call Eau Claire, 800-228-5615.